content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mary Grace Payton for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the U.S. News and World Report, Religion News Service, Economist, and the Associated Press News. Our first article was published by the U.S. News and World Report and written by members of the Associated Press on April 5, 2024, and is entitled, New York City to Pay $17.5 Million to Settle Suit Over Forced Removal of Religious Head Coverings During Mugshots, New York. New York City has agreed to pay $17.5 million to settle a lawsuit filed by two Muslim women who were forced to remove their head coverings to be photographed after they were arrested. The class action lawsuit was filed in 2018 by Jamila Clark and Ara Aziz, two Muslim women who said they felt ashamed and exposed when they were forced to remove their hijabs after they were arrested. When they forced me to take off my hijab, I felt as if I were naked. I'm not sure if words can capture how exposed and violated I felt, Clark said in a statement. I'm so proud today to have played a part in getting justice for thousands of New Yorkers. Clark was arrested on January 9, 2017, and Aziz was arrested on August 30, 2017. The lawsuit said police officers threatened to prosecute Clark, who was sobbing after being arrested for violating a bogus protective order filed by her abusive former husband if she did not remove her head covering. The lawsuit said Aziz, who also had been arrested because of a bogus protective order, felt broken when her picture was taken where a dozen male police officers and more than 30 male inmates could see her. City officials initially defended the practice of forcing people to remove head coverings for mugshots, saying the policy balanced respect for religious customs with the legitimate law enforcement needed to take arrest photos. But the police department changed the policy in 2020 as part of an initial settlement of the lawsuit and said it would allow arrested people to keep their head coverings for mugshots with limited exceptions, such as if the head covering obscures the person's facial features. The financial settlement was filed Friday and requires approval by Judge Annalisa Torres of Manhattan Federal Court. City Law Department spokesperson Nick Polucci said in a statement that the settlement resulted in a positive reform for the police department and was in the best interest of all parties. O. Andrew F. Wilson, a lawyer with Emery, Chelly, Brickerhoff, Abadi, Ward, and Mazel LLP, who is representing the women along with the Surveillance Technology Oversight Project, said, forcing someone to remove their religious clothing is like a strip search. This substantial settlement recognizes the profound harm to the dignity of those who wear religious head coverings that comes from forced removal. Polucci said the proceeds from the settlement will be shared by approximately 4,100 eligible class members. Wilson said that once the settlement is approved, the funds will be divided equally among everyone who responds by a deadline set by the judge, with a guaranteed minimum payment of $7,824 for each eligible person. Now an article from the Religion News Service, published on April 9 and written by Aleha Hertzler McCain, entitled, Dozens of Christians Arrested After Shutting Down Senate Lunch in Protest of Gaza Famine, Washington. Woe to you who eat while others go hungry, shouted two lines of Christian pastors and laypeople. With arms linked, they stood between the food and cash registers in the U.S. Senate cafeteria and brought lunch to a standstill for about half an hour before U.S. Capitol Police quickly completed arrest. Between 50 and 60 demonstrators demanding a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas, as well as aid for the ever-shrinking food supply in Gaza, were arrested on April 9 in the cafeteria. The interdenominational protest, organized by Christians for a Free Palestine, followed a communion service held on Capitol grounds. This table is a reminder that we are called to live in a way that may in fact hasten our death, said Reverend Naomi Washington Leaphart, who told protesters before she presided over communion. Because we are enemies of injustice, because we embarrass the state by our refusal to accept its ways. More than 25 children in Gaza have died due to complications linked to malnutrition, according to the World Health Organization, which has warned that the region could face a full-blown famine by May. Humanitarian officials have urged Israel to allow more food to enter Gaza. After an Israeli military airstrike hit a World Central Kitchen convoy on April 1, killing 7 humanitarian aid workers, President Joe Biden said Israel had not done enough to protect aid workers or civilians and called on Israel to do more to facilitate humanitarian corridors. But critics point out that the same day of the drone strike on the WCK convoy, Biden had signed off on the transfer of thousands of bombs to Israel. Starvation was weaponized against our people to bring them on their knees, the Reverend Mitri Raheb, a Palestinian theologian and founder of Dar al-Kalima University in Bethlehem, told the group gathered for communion ahead of the cafeteria protest. I wonder, actually, if not one of these bombs that were donated to Israel was the one that actually destroyed our campus in Gaza, Raheb said, referencing the destruction of the Dar al-Kalima University outpost in Gaza during Holy Week, days before the WCK attack. Organizers of Tuesday's protest repeatedly denounced Christian Zionism, a belief that Jews must return to Israel to bring about the return of Jesus. Rabbi Elisa Wise, lead organizer for Rabbis for Ceasefire, also spoke to the small crowd, telling the protesters their actions were a sign of solidarity and friendship with Jews by sharing the burden of the ways that our religious traditions have been instrumentalized to establish and maintain the state of Israel, adding there are more members of Christians United for Israel than there are American Jews. The group's leaders also call for a permanent ceasefire, an end to the provision of U.S. weapons to Israel, the restoration of funding for the UN Aid Agency for Palestinian Refugees, and the release of captives held by both Israel and Hamas. More than 33,000 people have been killed and more than 75,000 injured in Gaza, according to health officials in the Hamas-run enclave, since the beginning of Israel's military campaign after the October 7 Hamas attacks in Israel that left an estimated 1,200 people dead and 250 taken hostage. The Reverend Margaret Ernst, a United Church of Christ minister and leader with Christians for a Free Palestine, said those arrested included 30 ordained clergy, as well as Baptists, Lutherans, Catholics, Presbyterians, Mennonites, Unitarian Universalists, Quakers, and members of the United Church of Christ and the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. At the communion service, Larry Hebert, an active duty airman on the 10th day of a hunger strike, joined the Christian protesters. Hebert said he hopes to get other members of the military to speak up about the starvation in Gaza. The Christian tradition is one of incarnation and embodiment, Washington Leaphart, who was among the protesters who decided to risk arrest, told RNS. Living out my faith is a matter of complete embodiment. It is putting my body in the way of injustice and oppression. Tuesday's civil disobedience marked the second largest group of Christians arrested in protest at the Capitol since the war began. About 130 Mennonites were arrested at the Capitol in January after they held a hymn sing sit-in calling for a ceasefire in Gaza. And on October 18, about 300 or more interfaith protesters, most of them Jewish, were arrested as a part of a demonstration organized by Jewish Voice for Peace. Leaders with Christians for a Free Palestine said they drew direct inspiration from Mennonite Action, which organized the January hymn sing, including collaborating with some of the group's leaders. Jonathan Brenneman, a Mennonite and Palestinian American who has long worked with Palestinian and Israeli peacemakers and the Mennonite Church USA, took a leadership role in both actions. "Movements inspire more movement," he told RNS, "and that is what this moment calls for." Adam Raymer, one of the coordinators of Mennonite Action, had served as California Representative Ro Khanna's political director until Raymer resigned when Khanna refused to sign a ceasefire resolution in the weeks after October 7. Khanna backed a ceasefire on November 21. Christians for a Free Palestine leader said they are drawing on many of Mennonite Action's tactics, including organizing mass mobilization Zoom calls and days of action where Christians take local action at their elected officials' offices. Tuesday's protest follows a worldwide day of rallies on Sunday commemorating the six-month anniversary of the October 7 attacks and demanding the release of 133 hostages still held by Hamas, some of whom are presumed to be dead. After Tuesday's protest at the Capitol, a spokesperson for the U.S. Capitol Police told RNS, "Approximately 50 people were arrested for illegally demonstrating inside the Dirksen Senate office building this afternoon. It is illegal to demonstrate inside any of the congressional buildings. The charge is D.C. Code 22-1307, crowding, obstructing, or incommoding." Ernst Toll Nicola Torbett, a Pennsylvania-based organizer, helped the group plan the protest through a concept called liturgical direct action, where organizers started with scripture and asked questions such as, "What moves us in Christian worship? What's powerful about the Christian story?" The protest leaders said their nonviolent direct action comes from biblical tradition, pointing to the midwives who refused Pharaoh's command to kill infant Hebrew boys, and Jesus overturning the money changers' tables in the temple. Both the communion service and the obstruction of the cafeteria were designed to draw attention to the urgency of the famine in Gaza, Ernst said, explaining that Christians for a Free Palestine followed the advice of the U.S. campaign for Palestinian rights in focusing Tuesday's action on the famine. Ernst said organizers wanted the protest to be a transformative faith experience, and many spent the day before in Bible study, prayer circles, community building, and workshops. For Washington Leapheart, Tuesday's protest was about discipleship. "Jesus' work navigated a tension between comfort and safety that one may find in faith and disruption and risk and adventure that one finds in faith," Washington Leapheart said. "If I'm not taking enough risks, then I'm not really pushing myself to the limits of my faith." Now an article from The Economist, published on April 8, entitled, "How to Make Money from the Bible." America's 45th president has excellent taste in Bible translations. When deciding which one to endorse this Easter, Donald Trump chose the King James Version, widely considered to be one of the greatest works of English literature of the 17th century. Or rather, he chose a modern repackaging of it, dubbed the God Bless the USA Bible. This includes in one volume, The American Constitution, the lyrics of a country song called God Bless the USA, and the scriptures. "All Americans need the Bible in their home, and I have many. It's my favorite book," intoned Mr. Trump in a promotional video. Religion is so important, he added. We must make America pray again. And tacitly, pay again. The new book costs $59.99 plus postage. Mr. Trump is not selling it directly, but receives royalties with each purchase, according to the New York Times. Thus, he has entered the highly competitive business of trying to make a buck from the holy book. This is a new kind of venture for Mr. Trump, whose previous offerings have tended to be flashier. Gold-finished Trump sneakers for $399, and enticing Trump cologne for $99. The Bible, far from being a luxury object, inveighs against wealth. It tells of the life of a man who said things like, "Blessed are the poor," and "Love your enemies." Such sentiments are not easily mistaken for those of Mr. Trump, which include, "Part of the beauty of me is that I am very rich," and "The worst thing a man can do is go bald." The market in religious publishing is thriving in America. The recent StatsShot annual report from the Association of American Publishers found that revenues of religious presses had risen 7% in the first 10 months of 2023 to $674 million. A portion of that might defray at least some of Mr. Trump's sizable legal expenses. But this is a very unusual market with obstacles for new entrants. The biggest is that many suppliers insist on giving its most popular product away for nothing. The Gideons, a charity founded in 1899, have placed 2.5 billion Bibles and New Testaments in hotels, hospitals, and domestic violence shelters around the world, roughly one for every Christian man, woman, and child. Weary travelers yearning for gospel truths can simply reach into a bedside drawer and find some. Other groups have posted the entire Bible online so the faithful can search for their favorite verses. Against such unfair competition, can Mr. Trump compete? Probably, for several reasons. First, the revered text he is touting is not subject to copyright, a concept that did not exist when the King James Bible was first published in 1611. So he is demanding a high price for a text whose long-dead authors do not need paying, never mind scribbling notes in the margins of the books of the minor prophets. The profit margins on each copy of this book should be major. None of that will matter if no one buys the God Bless the USA Bible. But it has two celebrity endorsements. Lee Greenwood, the country star who sings God Bless the USA, is involved. And Mr. Trump is pushing the tome during a bitter election campaign to a vast number of followers, many of whom are passionate both about Scripture and about supporting the former president against its fiendish enemies. Others in the devotional publishing industry have faced the same challenge as Mr. Trump: how to refresh a blockbuster written thousands of years ago and come up with even more creative solutions. They cannot commission sequels by living authors, as the literary estates of Agatha Christie and Ian Fleming have done, to produce new Hercule Poirot and James Bond stories. But they can commission new translations, a huge task, or tailor versions for specific audiences. Thus, from Zondervan, the Christian arm of Harper Collins, you can buy the Boys Bible, gross and gory stuff you never knew was in the Bible. From a smaller German outfit, there is the Biker Bible, the whole New Testament and life stories of bikers. The Bible is long and confusing. Many modern readers yearn for shortcuts to passages that might be especially relevant and commentaries to aid comprehension. Others seek whimsy. You can buy the Mother's Bible, it's pink, or Bibles in regional dialects. A Glaswegian one opens with in the beginning. There are even scriptures in fictitious tongues such as Klingon from Star Trek or Kenya invented by J.R.R. Tolkien. Such experimentation is much easier with the Bible than it is with the Quran, and much easier today than in previous centuries. In the 16th century, the scholar William Tyndale translated the Bible from Hebrew and Greek into English in a way that displeased the church. He was later burned at the stake for heresy. The church was less tolerant of novelty in those days and created literal ghost writers. Since many people take the Bible literally, careful proofreading is essential. In 1631, printers in London accidentally left the word not out of the seventh commandment, thus rendering it as thou shalt commit adultery. This delighted many readers, but not the authorities. The printers were hit with ruinous fines and lost their license. The wicked Bible subsequently became a collector's item. Surviving copies are now valued at tens of thousands of dollars. Whether future generations will treasure Mr. Trump's Bible so dearly remains to be seen. And our last article was published by the Associated Press on April 7 and is entitled, Idaho Man Faces Federal Terrorism Charge. Prosecutors say he planned a church attack to support the Islamic State. Boise, Idaho. An 18-year-old man planned to attack churches in a northern Idaho city using a metal pipe, butane fuel, a machete, and if he could get them, his father's guns, according to federal prosecutors who charged him with attempting to provide material support to the Islamic State group. Authorities said Alexander Scott Mercurio adopted the Muslim faith against his Christian parents' wishes and was in contact with FBI informants posing as Islamic State group supporters. Mercurio was arrested Saturday, the day before investigators believe he planned to carry out the attack. Phone messages left for a relative and for his defense attorneys at the Federal Defenders of Eastern Washington and Idaho were not immediately returned. Mercurio did not immediately respond to an email through a jail inmate email system. Mercurio told one informant he intended to incapacitate his father with the pipe, handcuff him, and steal his guns and a car to carry out the attack in Coeur d'Alene, according to an FBI agent's sworn statement. The guns included rifles, handguns, and ammunition his father kept in a locked closet, but Mercurio still planned to attack with the pipe, fire, and knives if he couldn't get the firearms, alleged the sworn statement by FBI Task Force Officer John Taylor II. If he could get the key and access the closet, Mercurio said in an audio recording he gave the informant, "Everything will be so much easier and better, and I will achieve better things." The recording was to accompany a photo the informant took of Mercurio in front of the ISIS flag, holding up a knife and his index finger in a gesture commonly used by the group. After attacking the church, Mercurio told the informant he planned to attack others in town, as many as 21, before being killed in an act of martyrdom. Mercurio talked with confidential informants over a two-year span, and at one point tried to build an explosive vest to wear during the attacks. Mercurio told a confidential informant that he first connected with the Islamic State during the start of the COVID-19 pandemic, when schools were closed. And investigators later found several files on his school-issued laptop detailing the Islamic State's extremist ideology. Mercurio's parents disapproved of his beliefs, he allegedly told a confidential informant, and Mercurio eventually began to worry that he was a hypocrite for not carrying out the attack. "I've stopped asking and praying for martyrdom because I don't feel like I want to fight and die for the sake of Allah. I just want to die and have all my problems go away, he wrote in a message to the informant. On March 21, Mercurio sent a direct message to the informant, again, saying he was restless, frustrated, and wondered how long he could keep living in such a humiliated and shameful state. I have motivation for nothing but fighting, like some time of insatiable bloodlust for the life juice of these idolaters, a craving for mayhem and murder to terrorize those around me. I need some better weapons than knives. Law enforcement moved to arrest Mercurio after he sent an audio file pledging his allegiance to the Islamic State. Thanks to the investigative efforts of the FBI, the defendant was taken into custody before he could act, and now he is charged with attempting to support ISIS's mission of terror and violence, Attorney General Merrick Garland wrote in a press release. The Justice Department will continue to relentlessly pursue, disrupt, and hold accountable those who would commit acts of terrorism against the people and interests of the United States. If convicted, Mercurio could be sentenced to up to 20 years in prison. Mercurio has not yet had an opportunity to enter a plea. He's being held in a northern Idaho jail while he awaits his first court appearance, scheduled for late Wednesday morning. The Islamic State group took control of a large swath of territory in Syria and Iraq in 2014 and had been largely defeated on the battlefield by 2018. However, it maintains desert hideouts in both countries, and its regional affiliates operate in Afghanistan, West Africa, and the Far East. ISIS claimed responsibility for last month's Moscow concert hall attack that killed 145 people, the most deadly attack in Russia in years. We've run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News, so I hope you'll listen again next time. I hope you've enjoyed it. I am Mary Grace Payton, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Religion in the News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.